Accession number 18747, real one.
Mr. Harris, real one, where were you born, please?
Born in Sidcup in Kent in 1920.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Sidcup?
No, schooling was at Sevenoaks in Kent.
And when did you finish at school?
1938.
Just before the war started?
Correct, yes.
Had you anticipated at that time that a war would break out?
There were rumours, many rumours, similar to the rumours we get these days. Some people believe them and some don't. I think we were influenced by what we read in the newspapers and heard on the radio, not unlike the situation we're encountering today. But I don't think that the war seemed quite so imminent as it proved to be. There were stories, people went to holiday in Germany and they would return and say that they saw a lot of tanks, but those rumours were usually squashed by the newspapers by confirming that they weren't made of metal, they were made of three-ply. But I think history proved otherwise.
Had you any idea in 1938 as to what you might do should a war break out?
Yes. I was hoping, mainly due to the fact that I had spent a lot of my pocket money going to see epic films, Hell's Angels, Dawn Patrol, and one or two others, mostly American epics, showing airmen leaning over the side of the cockpit with a camera, usually a still camera, occasionally a movie camera, taking photographs of enemy territory, and always being keen on photography. In fact, the first movie I took was in 1929, when I was 9 years old. So I'd obviously got the bug of photography, which includes cinematography, well and truly in my blood. And I therefore thought if a war came, I would march in and sort of say, please, sir, may I fly in one of these aeroplanes, lean over the cockpit and take photographs of enemy territory.
And did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I certainly did. Certainly did.
And what was your reaction to that?
It was less than my parents' reaction. I think they were, having survived, lived through the First World War, they were very concerned, I suppose, having a son of ideal age to go and join the forces. But to me, it was another adventure. When one was young, one is put into a prep school, public school, put into work, and I had a job in 1939. Needless to say, connected with photography.
What was the job?
The job was working as an assistant salesman in Wallace Heaton's in New Bond Street. Wallace Heaton in Bond Street those days were appointed by appointment to Their Majesty. And on many occasions that I was editing many of the Royal Family films. The Queen Mother used to take quite a lot of cine films when our present Queen was just a schoolgirl. So photography was with me then and remained ever since.
Did the Second World War affect you very much to start off with?
No, because it was suggested I should wait until I get called up. And I think that must have been in about 1940. And I was called up and had to report to Stratford-on-Avon. At Stratford-on-Avon, obviously, we were subjected to a few more medicals, we had lectures, and quite a percentage of square bashing. I think it might be worth mentioning that when I went to the aircrew selection board, the first question they asked, what do you want to do when you get airborne? And I said, well, I want to be an observer, not a pilot. No, no. Why? And I think the reason is, as I started at the beginning of this interview explaining that I wanted to take photographs from the air of enemy territory. However, after a spell at Stratford-on-Avon, we were sent up to ITW at St Andrews in Scotland. Most of that was pretty solid square bashing. Afterwards, we were then dispatched to Canada as part of the Commonwealth Air Training Scheme. This would be in the year...
Well, according to your logbook, it says you're actually in Miami in January 42. So presumably you'd gone to Canada in 41.
That's right, yes. And in Canada, no training took place. We were simply marshalled there, awaiting instructions to be sent to one of the training camps in Canada or into the States, as it happened. We were very fortunate and sent down to Miami in Florida. On the way down, we went by train. On the way down, we were allowed 24 hours in New York, which we made the most of. When we arrived in Miami, we attended the University of Miami at Coral Gables, where we were instructed by Pan American Airways. They had a school down there for training many of their flying air crew, and I think it was there where the and the American China Clippers were flying. We saw many of them down there. The training there was extremely good, but of course, having come from English schools, the American approach was somewhat different. And instead of one person flying in an aircraft for training, eight of us were fitted into an American flying boat. We each had our own table and we each did our navigation. The instructor flew with us and he would from time to time gaze at our work and advise us whether we were going right or wrong. This lasted until, I would say, about 2 or 3 months into 1942.
What was the discipline like in Florida?
The discipline was Anglo-American. Part of the staff down there were RAF. The other half were American. I think the thing that struck me most was, of course, the hospitality. Every weekend, there were notices put up inviting cadets, as we were called, for various entertainments, which, of course, were fully appreciated by the cadets. Invitations to people's homes, and some were extremely luxurious. In fact, there was a time when I knew a girl, I wouldn't go so much as say that she was a girlfriend, but almost. It was her birthday, and her father arranged for a huge American car to be delivered at the house with ribbons on each handle and the big card saying to Marilyn, love from Pops. We next spent the next 2 or 3 weeks driving around. And I believe from memory the petrol was 9 cents a gallon. But I couldn't begin to work the equivalent to our present day prices.
Were American civilians uniformly friendly towards RAF?
I think friendly, it was more curiosity. They were not in the war. And I think many of them were hoping that they could be isolationists. They didn't really want to get into another European war. But of course, once Pearl Harbor had taken place, things changed rapidly. And I can remember going to the local pub, as we'd call them, I forget what they call them over there, where you'd go and get drinks. I can remember many Americans coming up to me, slapping me on the back and saying, "What are you drinking, bud? And by the way, don't forget to get a Jap for me." Which I'm afraid I wasn't able to do. No, it was a very friendly, enjoyable, very memorable time. And then to come back to England, well, what a difference. Blackout, wartime, even the flying was so different, because over there the weather was perfect, sunshine, no mountains. But of course you get to, we were stationed in Wigtown in Scotland, where there was mists, mountains, misery. But however, it certainly acclimatized us, I think was the object of the exercise. It certainly did that in a few weeks.
What did you think of the quality of the training you got in America?
I think considering the conditions, it was adequate. But of course the conditions that they were giving to American airline aircrew was a much easier proposition compared to the RAF at night flying bombers with fairly skimmily trained aircrews. But of course the losses were getting pretty high. And I think that time was scarce to give people the full amount of training. Although I certainly wouldn't say that as a navigator I was under-trained at all. But I think that thinking about the pilots who'd done a lot on single aircraft, we then went, they were then put on to Wellingtons, and we were crewed up to fly Wellingtons at OTU. We just about got that worked out when we were then put on to four-engine Stirlings.
What was a crewing up procedure?
Very haphazard. You were put into a huge hangar, and some fellow would stand on the box and say, "Now you get together, guys, and make yourselves into fives, crews of five. If you are unable to do it, we'll sort it out for you." And the same process was gone through when we went on to Stirlings. We went to a heavy conversion unit, I think it was 1651. There was a very similar instruction, right? You've got five of you got together, now you've got to have an engineer and you've got to have another gunner, making a crew of seven.
What was it like trying to work in both the Wellington and the Stirling?
My memory is absolutely so vague about the Wellington, but I can certainly remember flying in a Stirling, spacious. And as few people realised, the Stirling was 18 feet longer than a Lancaster. And the front of it was really like a railway coach. One had steps and stairs, bags of space, plenty of room. There were shortcomings, of course, because the aircraft was designed in the mid-30s. Things like heating were not first class. But on the whole, it was quite a well-designed plane, in my opinion.
Were any of the RAF bases at which you were training in 1942 attacked by the German Air Force?
No. No. Very lucky from that point of view. Because, of course, we did quite a lot of night landings, when I think that one was at risk with a pilot getting used to landing a Stirling at night. And suddenly a German night fighter could appear on your tail was extremely hazardous. But no, we never had any of those encounters, fortunately.
What were the main problems in doing your particular job in the aircraft in 1942?
I think the thing I'd like to mention, first of all, is the fact that I seem to be getting further and further away from my ambition of leaning out of a cockpit and photographing enemy territory. The nearest we got to was having to do IR. Now, that was infrared. For example, we would go on a night flight and we would have to find Conwy, North Wales. And to prove that we found it, we flew over this infrared light on the ground, and the bomb aimer would open the shutter on the camera, which was loaded with an infrared film. And if we had been successful in getting to the target, it would have registered on the film. But I thought, well, it was getting very remote photography from my point of view. But as for the normal flying, no, I think flying a Stirling was rather like a Wellington. And a Wellington was very like being trained to fly an Avro Anson. And that was not unlike flying boats in America. Navigation seems to be navigation whatever you're in. Except there was a big contrast after flying in Stirlings. One could take one's time, because the Stirling I would describe as our biggest and slowest bomber. And then when I found myself on a Mosquito, which was our smallest and fastest, the navigation had to be speeded up very considerably, and so were the cramped conditions to navigate. Whereas in a Stirling you had a nice spacious desk and instruments, in a Mosquito it's on your lap, on your knee, and half the time the bits and pieces were falling on the ground.
What did you think to G?
Our lifesaver. But it was not the miracle we'd hoped, because when we were training, you'd fly all over this country and think, oh, well, this is marvellous. But, of course, once you were on to operations and you got over enemy territory, it was jammed and the range was somewhat limited. So, of course, you had to fall back on the real basic of navigation, and that was DR reckoning, DR. And that, of course, was using the flight plan, which he'd worked out prior to the raid.
I noticed from your logbook that you went to your first squadron at the beginning of December 1942. Can you tell me about that, please?
I think life on the squadron is a little bit hazy. Why? Because at times we were doing two nights on operations and one off, which means that one can get through a tour fairly quickly. I mean, tours in those days were 26-30 operations, and if you are doing them at that speed, I find that trying to remember very much about flying in those conditions is getting a bit vague in my memory, unfortunately. It was an exciting time, and one, you know, I would never regret, I can say that, having returned from flights on Stirlings, which I gather had the highest casualty rate of all our aircraft.
The squadron was 15 Squadron at Bourne. Whereabouts is Bourne?
I suppose that's about 8 miles northeast of Cambridge.
Did you get any kind of reception when you arrived at Squadron?
No. No, you were just received. It's a bit like booking in at a hotel, you know, name, number, right. You're in hut so-and-so. And I think somebody showed you where it was, and from then onwards you were in.
So you didn't receive any rallying speeches about what a good squadron it was and so on?
Possibly. But I think the anxiety of getting one's personal bits and pieces sorted out, finding how quickly one could get to Cambridge when you had a night off, where was the naffy, what was the food like, seemed to be more important than being told by the CEO that he was glad to see you. The reason he was glad to see you would be, of course, due to the fact that so many of his existing aircrew hadn't returned. But I don't think he rubbed that in too much, but I think we read between the lines.
How did you get to Cambridge?
You could get a bus, coach, cycle. The hazard was, of course, if you cycled, you were lucky if the bike was still there when you went back for it. But most of the time, I think we had coaches to take us in and out, providing one didn't miss the last one, which I think was at 11 o'clock. If you did, well, it was a long walk, which I did many times.
Where would you go to in Cambridge?
Well, one should mention first there was a dance hall, I think it was called the Dorothy, where one could meet many people, male and female. Perhaps before that you'd call into some of the various pubs, you work them out, because certain pubs only had deliveries of beer on certain days. But very quickly you knew which pubs to go to.
Would you have any contact with the academic population?
No, no. No particular reason. I think it was just that you would go into Cambridge with usually a member of your crew who'd say, well, you know, we're not on tonight. Let's go and beat up Cambridge was the, I think, the expression we used to use. And it was just a matter of having a night off at the pub, getting a meal or going to a dance hall. But very enjoyable on the whole, very enjoyable.
Did you ever come across any disorder in Cambridge?
No. We did hear that some of the boys, were a bit riotous, but I don't remember anything very serious. I think the usual drunken brawl, and that was about all.
Now, before we go on to operations, can you tell me about the composition of your air crew at Bourne, please?
Yes. Pilot was an accountant. He came from Taunton in Devon. And when we were told to get ourselves together in a crew, I looked at him and he was very young, boyish looking, blue eyes, fair hair. And I approached him and I said, are you by any chance looking for, can I be your navigator? And he says, yes, that's okay. So I said, have you got any other members of the crew yet? No, he said, I expect they'll come along. We then got hold of a wireless operator. I can't remember what he was in civilian life. The bomb aimer appeared from somewhere. Two gunners. And I suppose in a matter of half an hour, we'd got our crew assembled. We'd partly formed it when we were on a Wellington squadron, a Wellington OTU. We'd got five of us already. So I'm a little bit vague as to what these lads did. Our engineer, very appropriately, was a Scotsman, so that was okay. No, sorry, I can't remember too much about them.
What was the quality of the crew like?
Quite up to standard, I think. Unless you had flown before with another similar crew, I think it's rather difficult to judge quality unless you've got a standard to judge it by. But I would have said our crew was quite up to the standard of any of the others on the squadron.
I noticed your first two operations, 4th and 7th of December 1942, were gardening operations. Do you remember those?
Yes. Rather uneventful. I think most of them were to the Frisian Islands, which of course make up a considerable amount of the Dutch coast. You'd simply find you had to navigate to a latitude and longitude figure, open the bomb doors and the bomb aimer released the mines. He was given instructions, I think they were put down in various second delays. But here again, the photography wasn't employed then, it was just a question of navigating to the spot, and he'd open the bomb doors and release these mines. We used to think it was a rather uneventful, but it's amazing the number of aircraft that were lost mine laying, particularly in Stirlings. Don't ask me why. No, there's not very much to say about that. I suppose the most interesting mine laying operation we had was when we went down to the Gironde. That's the west coast of France. Now, we were putting mines across the entrance to the Gironde, which of course is the waterway which leads up to Bordeaux. And of course the U-boat pens were there. So I suppose the object of laying the mines across that was to get the shipping, and most important, I suppose, the U-boats.
In your logbook, that appears to have been the 11th of February 1943. And you then, on the 20th of December 1942, you put an operation on Duisburg, which was abandoned. Do you remember that one?
Yes, the pilot was having problems with the aircraft. Technically, I can't relate exactly what went wrong, but he was finding that, I think it was the port wing was tending to drop. It was something to do with engine settings. We returned, but my poor skipper got torn off for returning early by the wing commander, who was Wing Commander Menor. I think he thought we were he was showing a little bit of LMF, but it was just the opposite, because my skipper was quite a daredevil. However, that event was soon forgotten, and I think we were then lucky to carry on and complete the tour, which I think included three Berlin trips and a Turin trip, and of course the usual heavily defended German targets in the Ruhr, Hamburg. I can't remember the others, but it was quite an assortment.
Did you ever come across the phenomenon of LMF during the war?
No, no. We heard about it, but since reading various books, I think it was just handled so quietly and quickly, I don't think one was aware of it.
Can you take me through the procedure that you would personally go through before an operation, a typical operation?
Yes. We would in the morning be informed that we were on duty that night. We were not aware of the target, although by talking to the ground crew, who would